Hello, Yes But Why listeners. This is your host, Amy Jordan. Welcome to episode 220 with improviser VJ Delos Reyes. But first, a bit about our sponsor. This episode of Yes But Why podcast is sponsored by Audible. You can get your free audiobook download and your 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. Guys, I don't know about you, but I'm not getting out of the house as much as I used to. And with the tiny tyrant at home, I need a break. So I leave the kiddo at home with Chris and I take long drives, just to get a breather, you know? And Audible is my new sidekick. I Bluetooth it in the car and then it just reads me stories and distracts me from the world. It's my new form of self-care. Let it be yours too. Audible is available for your iPhone, Android, or Kindle. Download your free audiobook today at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. This week on Yes But Why, I talked to Canadian improviser and film actor VJ Delos Reyes. VJ is a positive and kind-hearted soul. He was great to talk to. We talk about balancing family life with performing and teaching and having a day job. We talk about VJ's recent announcement to his improv community that he's decided to retire. Still, I don't think this is the last we're going to hear from VJ Delos Reyes. I now present to you Yes But Why, episode 220. You ain't seen nothing yet from actor VJ Delos Reyes. Enjoy. I'm Amy Jordan, and this is Yes But Why podcast. Yeah.
My first introduction to, I guess, the creative side or improv would have been back in high school. My first scene that I was in, it was me and two friends of mine who eventually we end up forming a group together after high school. I really don't remember the details of it. It was about, I remember there was a pig involved and I played the pig for some strange reason. And I loved every single moment. The fact that they get to ride my back and I could be just this crazy warthog type pig. And to me, I thought that was being creative. And then eventually it just led into more of what I liked about not just improv, but acting itself. Like I could just be a complete idiot and have fun with it and show, you know, emotions and different type of emotions. And, you know, but then when I got to my professional career,
Wait, hold on. You acted as a pig. I need to know more about this pig. You were a pig. Did you guys write a scene and play? And so you were like, here's a pig. And you were like, I'll play the pig.
It was an exercise where we had to, I think it was grade 9, where my teacher was introducing us how to emulate characters of animal-like traits. So you're still human, but you have the character traits of a pig or a giraffe, right? And so that would help us get into a character. But I don't think I read it right or whatever. And it was all improvised too. So I went out there as a pig and started talking like I was a pig. But then afterwards, my teacher was like, "You do know the exercise was about human characters, human actors playing characteristics of an animal. You chose a pig and you became a pig." No. And I was like, okay. And so it just, no. It still stuck with me. And I was like, okay, that's not what I'm going with. But eventually we did it again and we did a few more improv scenes and eventually become like part of a play. I don't know what the play was called, but it was part of a play that I never actually played the character of the pig again, but somehow that character, I guess, inspired my director to write something based on the fault of an actor not doing things properly. It was weird. It was like weird. But then I just started learning how to become like getting familiar with my body more It was weird. It was like a weird grade 9 moment in my life.
Can you imagine for a second this teacher? Like, they're like, yeah, listen, whatever you want to do in that theater class is fine. If you want to, like, do improv exercises to make a play, that would totally be cool. She's like, great, awesome. I'm going to do this now. I'm writing Lord of the Flies, but it's going to be created by weird improv exercises that, like, 14-year-olds are doing for me. Like, what?
And that was the thing too. My drama teacher was remarkable. Like, his name is Michael Reed, and he was such a great facilitator to my whole acting time in high school. He introduced me to improv, and he told me about companies out in Vancouver that do things like this. And I was like, okay. And so we did a school field trip, which was weird. It was like at night at like 7:30, 8 o'clock on a Wednesday night, and we're going on a school field trip to watch improv. And I was hooked from there. And then I realized, oh man, you can do almost anything in the world of improv. And so I sort of balanced a little bit both. But the pig thing was something that really scarred me for a long
time. Yeah.
It brought bad memories.
Also, the person who told you no was not Michael Reed, right? This was a like female teacher previous?
No, it was like a student aide. And because I think the student A was graduating, he felt like he had this sort of like hierarchy to lower grade students. And he wasn't mean about it. If I remember, he wasn't mean about it. He was just being like, oh no, that's not how it's supposed to go. Like, he was supportive, but also like a little belittling. But it was kind of funny at the same time. Like, he was like, I loved it, but no, that's not how it's supposed to go.
Oh man. I hate that, man. No, no.
Yeah, I was like, oh, I thought I was doing good.
Yeah, right? You were doing great. Doesn't matter what you did. You did something, and that's amazing. Yeah. Oh, man. People then, with high hopes of high school theater, they're ridiculous.
Especially in grade 9, where right? Your hopes were your dreams. You didn't care. You were just being ridiculous and trying to be funny for your friends. And
trying desperately.
I was trying to be approved. I was trying to get approval from my classmates, and they liked it.
Yeah.
So I think that revolutionized of how I was going to start doing shows based on that, on the audience reaction. Really, I was like, I'm going to perform for myself because this is fun.
Yeah. So you said you started a group with your friends. Did you guys start doing improv on your own time outside of the theater classes you had with Mr. Reed?
Well, so what had happened was in my grade 12 year, I was not really part of an improv troupe until after high school. But what had happened, I had a group of friends, probably 5 of them, who were probably a year or two older than me. They had an improv troupe with, called, and get this, their name was 43 Pounds of Wasted Space. That was the name of their improv troupe. And so me and 2 of my friends, we were in grade 12, and there was this TV show, a local TV show here in Vancouver called Sportscast. And it was basically like high school drama teams, primarily improv, would battle each other out for, you know, improv supremacy or whatever in Vancouver. And I was on the winning team that won the whole thing. And because the 5 friends who were older than us, they were going to go on a Europe trip, but they had a manager at the time too. But they were like, we can't, you guys can't lose this momentum. So you guys need to find replacements for you guys. So when you guys come back, the troupe will still be going. And so they asked us to join. And I think probably one or other person, I can't remember, but they asked us to join. And so we did random shows, shows for like summer camps for handicapped students, and it was great. It was fantastic, and it was something that, because by then I was graduating. I already graduated from high school, and I was like, okay, this is what I'm doing for a bit. Given though I have a day job,
yeah,
I'll do this on the side too. And so we got to do so many shows, and then the one big moment was meeting like a Canadian hockey legend, Gordie Howe, doing an improv show in
Ooh.
Front of him. I don't know how hammered he was, but he seemed to enjoy it. but and then eventually when those 5 gentlemen five gentlemen came back from their trip from Europe, they heard so many great things from the manager that they said, well, why don't you guys join us? And so we ended up becoming a group of eight, and then another person joined in a year after us. And so we were like all male troop. And I was the only person of color, but it never really mattered to me because I was like, oh, you guys accept me for doing my skill stuff and whatever. So, and we did shows left and right for like New Year's Eve shows in Vancouver. And, you know, it was sort of like, it was kind of cool because we were sort of, we felt like rock stars in a way, given though it was improv. And we just went all over, like, I think in 1 year, we did probably like 150 shows. And wow. for people who did just graduated from high school, man, you can't get that. It was awesome, like doing shows in front of people who didn't even know us. And we used to do shows in front of friends, but then that blossomed into a bigger venue for us, and doing shows in, like a weekly thing at a local theater. And it just became like so much fun that we inspired another group of high school students that was within our living proximities in Vancouver, that they formed their own troupe called the Backward Zone. And so in the North Vancouver area, which is a district in Vancouver, it was two improv troupes performing on the same area. And then we had Vancouver Theatre Sports League that was doing their own thing. Obviously, we all, both groups all fell in love with Vancouver Theatre Sports League and what they brought to improv and how it inspired us. And and then unfortunately it started tapering down for all of us. Some of us got married, some of us wanted to do other things. And I was the only one that really kept on going with it. And that was like, man, I think about it now, I think that was like 96, 97 when we officially sort of shut down that troupe. And I was the only one that kept on going with another troupe that I helped form. To this day, we're actually still friends with my second group too. So
did you, how great. Many years did you do 43 pounds?
So I graduated in 92. I think we did it for, I want to say 5 years. 5 years. And then at that time, near the tail end of that time, I thought, you know what, maybe I could help other students form their own improv troupe and I could be sort of their manager and whatnot. And so I started going around the high schools and whatever, and just like sort of like scouting. I was like a scout, but it was kind of weird because I was like talking to students and then they would have to talk to their parents and they would ask me questions. So I was like, okay, I'm not going to do that anymore. I'm going to go to the school that I know, which is my old high school, and ask students there because they know me. So, and then we just formed the group and we held auditions, and that group ended up that group that I ended up forming myself was, they were known as the Right Side Prodigy. And then that company, that troupe sort of fizzled out after a year or two. And then at the same time, the Backwards Zone, the other troupe in North Vancouver, started phasing out. But then me and a friend of mine collaborated together. It's like, why don't we both collaborate together with forming a troupe, like a comedy troupe that does sketch comedy and improv and everything else. And we could have some musical entanglements in there too. And so we ended up forming a company called Sketch, which was, which was an improv / sketch comedy group. And you know, that company phased out after 5-7 years of performing with each other, but we're still, to this day, still close friends. Whenever we all meet up, we still laugh at those times. And I'm actually still really good friends with one of them too. So
was that just a troupe and you went to different venues, or did you have a brick and mortar as well?
We went to different venues. Like, we went as far to the point where one of our guys, he had a contact with an animator who was writing shows for kids shows for a show for India and Singapore. And so that guy, the writer, knew of us and was like, hey, why don't you guys come on down and start laying down voice work for us? And so we were thrilled. And then obviously we brought more people in to help us out, but it was like, I guess we did a lot of shows. And then we did a lot of shows with that group. And then at the same time, I was part of another group, which was three Filipino guys. We were known as FOB, fresh off the boat. And we started doing improv musical sketch comedy competitions, just us three, while the sketch group started phasing out, which was like a 5, maybe 6 year term of running with those guys, that the FOB started picking up a lot more steam. We won, me and two of my buddies, we ended up winning like two back-to-back sketch comedy competitions. Because I was with Theater Sports at that point, then another gentleman was also with Theater Sports. So we had this comedy background fixed that we never really went anywhere with it though. That was the only thing. We couldn't complete what we wanted to do. And that was to go back to the Philippines and showcase Canadian Filipinos doing improv in front of our homeland people. I think that was the one regret that we couldn't do, because one of us got married, one of us started doing their own show, and I was doing shows with Theater Sports. So it was sort of all became a disheartening dream, but I think somewhere down the road we'll still do it, but we're all busy right now.
Yeah, but you're still friends with those guys, you know, because it's not like gone forever. You could still plausibly
No, like in fact, one of the guys, his name is Chris Casillan. He's with Theater Sports as well as I am. And so him and I, we still see each other. And this other gentleman, Dave Demopoulos, him and I still keep in close contact. So we're still all in close contact. We haven't done a show for like almost, like as three of us, almost for like 4 years as a troupe. Because we've all gotten lives all of a sudden. Like my friend Dave had got married and had two kids. Myself, I got married, I have a single kid. And Chris Casillan is constantly touring the world under the blanket of this company, this comedy group called the Comic Strippers, where it's like 5 or 6 guys dressed up as Chippendales. They're all known as Chip, and they're all doing improv scenes, and somehow music kicks in, and they start playing to the audience, which predominantly are all women, and they start, you know, becoming like really like Chippendale dancers, and then when the music stops, they go back into the scene again. So doing that for they've traveled all over the world.
You sell improv. Oh, that is how you do it. Good Lord.
They've gone places, and I give them all props to them.
So
like,
funny.
And not to take any away from them, good on them.
Oh, it's awesome.
Their bodies are not the greatest.
So
when they do shows, they're always wearing just a purple bow tie and purple spandex.
I love it.
Shirtless.
That's the best.
And so
I hope they're also fat and hairy. That's what I hope. That's all I want.
And they also added a female, who obviously is not going to be naked. She covers herself up, and she calls herself Chip as well too. She's got a fake mustache, fake toupee, and she does the same thing, but with the shirt on. But yeah, that's what I mean. I'm still in close contact with all those people. Yeah,
you know. So I wanted to ask you, a lot of the stuff that you've mentioned is a lot of what people refer to as like indie troupes, like not troupes associated with a particular theater or a group or a community, but like you created a lot of stuff on your own. Like, how did you like know, was it because of the troupe that you were in with the manager and stuff that you like sort of knew the framework of what you needed to build to do these shows? Cause like, I didn't know what to do until I got taught by somebody, you know what I mean? Like, but you're creating stuff out of nothing. How's that?
I think because so my first group was 43 pounds. There was 9 guys or 8 to 9 guys, and me, because I was so fresh and new into the world of doing improv, I guess professionally, I didn't really say much because I needed to know I'm doing this right, and everyone else, the guys who formed it before I did, obviously had a lot of say. And so there was one gentleman, he really took the reins on what their next show would be or an idea, and we all followed suit. And so I would sort of be attached to the hip on him because I wanted to see like what promotional ideas he had and how to get us all involved into really selling our shows. And he did a lot of legwork. He was more the contact from us to our manager and vice versa. So he was the hub. And so, but for booking venues and whatnot, I had to learn the hard way. Like I would have to say, hey, can we do a show? You guys could take the full profits. and at the end of the night, we'd be like, oh, so we got nothing out of that show? Okay, well, thank you for the venue. It was type of that, like those type of things. And I to this day, I still have a tough time trying to bargain if there was a venue opening, like how to get some profit out of that to benefit us. But it was trial and error. Like I think we did about 15 shows completely free under my guidance. Yeah. and none of the players were asking for it. They weren't asking for money. They were just happy to do shows that they wanted to do even after high school.
Dude, that's awesome. I love that you figured it out and that you're, propelling forward what you wanted to make, that it's just really like not a lot of people do that. I've definitely encountered a lot of people who need somebody else to take them along the way. So it's really awesome that, you met people that like taught you cool and interesting things. And then it like just propelled you forward to make it happen. When you said that you helped that other group, like not everybody is trying to like make other people famous or like help them. Right. You could have been like, yeah, I'm the best. Let me go show you how I'm great. Instead, you're like, let me help other people have a great experience. Like I did. Like that's admirable.
Yeah. And I think, it's funny too, because I think within that time of 43 pounds sort of phasing out, Right Side Prodigy sort of phasing out, and then Sketch, and this, I think Fresh Off the Boat sort of came later on. But between that time, my friend who him and I had talked about forming a group together, he wanted to put on a high school improv tournament because he remembered me doing shows for this, again, this TV show called Sportscast. So he wanted to sort of bring something back like that for local high school students to do improv and whatnot. So it gave me the opportunity to go into the schools doing improv workshops and whatnot. That actually became so rewarding for me that there was one school, I remember there's a national competition here in Canada called the Canadian Improv Games. And what it is that it's basically like schools all across Canada, a team of eight students would do improv scenes based on certain themes or story arcs or whatever. And they would get scored, and the top team in each province would represent that province and then fly over to the capital, which is Ottawa. And then they would battle out each other. And then if you won, you were the top improv team in Canada. And so what had happened, I actually felt sorry for this one school that I ended up becoming their coach I think that was 1999, 98, 99, where I started coaching this one team. And they always finished dead last in the competition. And the one year I asked two of my friends to help me coach them because I didn't know anything about the Canadian Improv Games format. They helped me. And from dead last the year before, they finished first place, and yeah, that got me more interested into possibly coaching. And that was where really the coaching bug sort of took off for me. Like I started coaching the same school, and they became not that they were disrespected or didn't look at it. It was like, for me, it was like, I want to help these kids know that improv is fun. And whenever these guys were doing improv before I showed up, they were sort of disheartened, and you could see in their eyes that they wanted to be like the other teams who were just so good and whatnot. So I thought I'd sort of give them back, but that became that became a 10-year journey of me coaching one school, leaving that school, going to another school, and then going back to the same school. It was 10 years of doing that. And by 2010, I sort of stopped. The biggest reward out of all that was in 2010, one of the parents asked me if I could organize a group of students that I have had access or had coached or whatever, and if they could be part of the 2010 Olympics. And so I had students roving around as alien ski board kids, while delegates from like Ukraine, Japan, Jamaica coming on down. Our booth was right next to the top athletes of their particular sport. It was so surreal. So when the Olympics happened, we relished it. And that was probably when I last coached a improv team.
Did they perform in the Olympics?
Well, they did roving. They didn't really perform. So they roved.
Not like around on a stage, so but like they did character work at the convention?
Yeah. Nice. Yeah, they would walk around. They would walk around. And obviously, I had to sort of retrain them, because at that point they were just done with improv because there was like 6 months. Like when I was coaching teams, I would coach for like probably 4 or 5 months. And it was like 3 rehearsals every week for like 4 hours, just getting ready for a competition. And by the time their competition season was over, they were just mentally drained. And that was the last thing they wanted to do, was do more improv. And so, really, I told them, I was like, if you guys have a choice, you don't have to do it, but think about it. It's the Olympics. How often do you get to do that and like wear a colored spandex over your face and body and just roam around like you're this alien character and just taking pictures with them and whatever? And I was like, you guys, let's do it. Why not? And they loved it.
So awesome.
And I loved it.
Yeah,
I loved it. And we met so many athletes. One of my students at the time sat next to a lady who eventually later on, I think in that week, won the gold medal for ski boarding. Like it was so surreal. And she's from Canada too. From Vancouver. And so it was like, we were rubbing shoulders with athletes that obviously we never really paid attention to the sport, but yet here we are. And it was a great time. But that was my whole improv thing. Like I was all about coaching and teaching.
Yeah, teaching. You're really such a teacher. I feel like your vibe of teaching has been there since the beginning, though. You've been like supportive and helping people, trying to help them get organized. I mean, that's pretty great.
Yeah.
I mean, did you always want to be a teacher or?
No, I think because my drama teacher had a huge impression on me, because he loved the craft of drama, like the art of acting. He taught us to respect it. Like he taught us that you could do what you want to do, but you have to respect that stage. And I will help you with that. And if you go out of line, or if you happen to say, you know, the Mac B word, the Shakespearean Mac B word, I will tell you, and I don't have to explain it to you because you know that it's kind of bad. And so it was stuff like that. I had a great mentor, my drama teacher, who taught us. And the funny thing is, actually, my first group, 43 Pounds of Waste Space, we all graduated from the same high school. We were probably a year or two apart from each other, but we were all taught by the same teacher. And that's where we all knew each other and got comfortable knowing each other. And that was all. And our drama teacher was actually the first one to set up the first gig for those five. Like he set up the first outside gig for the first five guys that started the improv troupe. So he left a big impression of how to really respect the stage and respect the theater. And, you know, like most schools nowadays don't have the proper drama atmosphere. And so they'll treat it with such disrespect. And I take that to heart. And so, not that I would crease into these students, because I went into these schools as a volunteer coach. I could have easily just picked up and left and not come back. But it meant so much to me to have these kids succeed and have them appreciate what I truly love and what I really love giving back to these kids. And they actually, I would, even when the improv season was done at their local high schools, I would actually do it like probably once, maybe twice a week until the end of the school year of doing lunch hour shows. I would actually have like a website built and say, hey, you know what? Go on to this website and you'll see who's cast for the show for the noon hour. And that was, I sort of treated it like it was like a professional company. That was what's so weird. It's like I'm living the life of theater sports and I'm actually replicating that at the local high school. I actually bought like a website and the domain name so students of their high school could actually look it up. It's like, oh, so-and-so is playing. Okay, I'll come see a lunch hour show. It's pretty neat.
That's awesome.
On pretty strong for like four years. I went on pretty strong during that. And then I just got tired.
Sure.
Just got tired doing it.
Volunteering, sure. Not also like super hard to be doing when you're, you know, not really getting as much from it. Though, you know, I'm sure you're getting plenty of like, you know, soul work out of it. Really great, the work that you're doing for those kids. I mean, and thank goodness for Mr. Reed for inspiring you, because like, you know, you were there for those kids. They needed a theater person to show them that it was cool and how to like do the business part. You know, think of all of them that learned from you that probably right now are like putting on their own shows because you showed them how to do it. Like, that's really great.
Yeah. I think what's fascinating too, because I've obviously my time with theater sports, I haven't really seen those students, and they graduated back in 2014, maybe even earlier than that. And there was probably maybe a couple of years ago, one of them, maybe two of them came back to do training at theater sports. And I was like, what? It's like, yeah, I sort of missed this. We want to get back into it again. But they never continued on. But the fact that they had thought about doing it again, I was like, oh, that meant a lot. I was like, well, that's great. Maybe we could, maybe eventually you could probably move up and you and I could do start doing shows professionally. But alas, they didn't do it. They didn't continue it. But the fact that they really loved doing it. They loved it, and I was rewarded with a lot of good friendships and out of that, because eventually they became my friends, and I'd have them on Facebook. So at times I keep track of what they're doing and how they're all doing and whatnot. So, yeah, it was something for me. It's like I always wanted to give something back because my teacher gave me something that I always loved. And sketch comedy was one part that was one half of what I really loved, and I rarely wrote sketch comedy. And so I thought I'd try it with my friends called Sketch, and you know, and not to say we were successful in it, but it gave me a sense of like, okay, so we do improv and let's see if we can try to replicate that onto page, onto paper, and start writing. And I think we were okay with that. We didn't do a lot of writing courses. One of my closest friends was like an amazing writer. He used to write grants for a lot of things. So he was also in the arts and writing scripts for plays and whatnot. So I tapped into his sort of knowledge and asked him for his help and see how we get into sketch comedy stuff. And, you know, but more so my background was always been improv. And I've always done that. And then it helped me doing like a lot of film and TV stuff too.
So when you said you were working in with the high schools for about 10 years until 2010, now during the time that you're working with the high schools, you also mentioned there was an overlap with Vancouver Theater Sports. Did you like go over there and start working with them and you were doing your own stuff and working within the institution, or how did that work for you in your path?
So what had happened, so between that overlap, before 2010, I had a day job. I was selling shoes. And nice. Then the odd time was for part-time. So on the side, I would actually, if I wasn't working at my day job, I would be at the school teaching. And then if I had to work the next day, I would be working the next day. But where theater sports really came into play for me was 2007. But prior to that, I was still in my training process of theater sports. So my schedule to them for theater sports was only on Saturday afternoons doing training, workshops, whatever. So I balanced it out. But then come 2007, early 2007, that's when it became a little bit of a balancing juggling act, because then I had my day job. I was so committed to coaching these teams. But then at night I had to do shows at theater sports. And so it would be, it would be, if I accumulate the volunteer hours with the high schools and shows, I think on average, I was thinking about doing, I think I was doing on average about 50 hours a week of like both my day job, theater sports shows, coaching, and all that, and then rinse and repeat over and over again every week.
Honestly, I think you're lowballing. I legitimately think it's way more than that. 50 hours? There's no way you're only putting 10 hours a week into your high school coaching and your shows whatnot at Vancouver. There's Vancouver Theatre Sports. There's no way.
And that,
like 70 and then hours that was also, a week.
And also, that was the year, actually. 2007 was the year. So this is where it really rewarded me with the coaching. So we did a night show at the local high school for these kids to finish off their year. I produced a show for these kids to say thank you for the crowd, thank you to the audience for supporting them during this whole improv season. And in there, one of the mothers of one of the kids I was working with came up to me. He's like, hey, listen, someone wants to meet you right now. Do you have time? And it was a casting director for a TV show.
Whoa.
And I was like, sure. So I talked to her. I was like, hey, listen, do you have an agent? I'm like, no, I don't. Actually, I haven't even thought about having an agent for almost 10, 15 years. It was never on my mind. It's like, okay, how about this? Don't worry about that. I want you to read for me in 3 days for a TV show called this Canadian show called Intelligence. It's an audition. I'm like, sure. okay. And so 3 days later, I go into this elevator and I go into this casting room. And, but before that I was in this elevator with this gentleman who was like this scraggly old guy, white pointy beard, bald, and he just looked like he shouldn't be there. And I get out and he's getting up on the same floor with me, and all of a sudden I look around, and then now take in mind, Amy, like it's been almost maybe 10 years since I last auditioned, maybe when I was still in high school when I was auditioning, and I haven't auditioned at that point for quite some time. So it was kind of surreal going back into an auditioning scenario where I see all these other people who sort of look like me. And I was like, oh, weird. Okay. And so I went in there, and lo and behold, the gentleman that was with me in the elevator was the creator of the show. And the creator of the show was a huge advocate of people of color, especially on his Canadian show. So not that I thought about that as a reason that I would probably get cast or whatever. I was like, this is crazy. I'm actually auditioning. And I eventually got a hold. So the next day I got a call from this gentleman who happened to be my agent then or now at that point. And he's like, hey, let's talk. And so we were talking, and while we were talking, he gets a call from the casting director. He's like, hey, that guy, so-and-so, can you tell me he booked the role? I'm like, sure. So during the interview with this casting director or this agent, he's like, hey, so congratulations, you booked the role. Do you want me to sign you now? and that's how it all happened. Like, I got a casting director who saw me host a high school improv show, and then it led me to doing an audition and booking my first ever TV role. It was a very small role for that, but it was like, I didn't know what I was doing. And
dude, awesome.
And then later on that year, probably a month later, the executive director of Theatre Sports called me into his office. He's like, hey, listen, I know you're done with your two-year training. We want to move you up to main stage. And so I was just like, everything was happening all at once. Like, all of a sudden I got a booking role on a TV show for a Canadian TV show. All of a sudden I'm getting moved up from my training to main stage roster of Theatre Sports. And it was just like, oof, what's going on? And then that summer became even more of a whirlwind where I was booking TV shows left and right while working my day job. And then like school by then was already in their summer season, so I had no coaching. But then I was like, had my day job at Theatre Sports doing doing the acting on film and TV, I was like, whoa, this is crazy. And then the following year was the big one for me, and it's still paying off for me, was booking my first movie, my first feature movie. And it was kind of surreal seeing like the guy who directed Macaulay Culkin and all the Harry Potter movies. He was the one directing me. I'm like, why am I doing this? How is this possible? And I think I was just in the right place in the right time.
What was the movie?
Percy Jackson and the Lightning Thief. I played one of five janitors who turned into a five-headed dragon or a hydra.
Yeah, and you did.
Yeah, it was great. It was a great experience. And you know, I was on set for 9 days, and during that time I met probably some of the coolest guys who were my co-stars, that one of, to this day, actually two of them I still keep in close contact. But yeah, it was one of these things where I'm sitting there in my trailer having a smoke. All of a sudden, Pierce Brosnan walks by. Uma Thurman's walking right behind him. I'm like, what is going on? In the span of a year, things just turned around for the better for me. It was great, but I honestly had to pinch myself. Because then when school went back in again, I went back into my old routine, day job, coaching, the odd time doing theater sports show. But that was, I fell in love with film and TV even more so. And then I kept on pushing for it. And then it just sort of faded out of me. I sort of lost the love of film and TV, and I wanted to do something else and whatnot.
Were you like doing stuff and then it kind of like fizzled away, like there wasn't as much going on? Or did you do like a role and it just left a bad taste in your mouth? And you don't have to give details.
I was doing roles. I was booking small roles. And I think it was because at that time I had a day job. And then the fact that I had an audition during a day at times, that would take me away from part of my work and then do this audition and go back to work. So it was it was my own preparation reading sides. I guess I was more committed to my day job, that I couldn't really put in the time and effort the night before for my sides, when it came to auditioning. Cause when I went to the audition room after, after doing a part of my job, my day job, I was stressed out. I was like kind of stressing out because I didn't know my lines, or I may forget it. And then I was walking there with like sweating buckets, but it was because I was running from one place to another and whatnot. But I mean, my all time favorite role that I ever did was playing a janitor. Like I didn't say it, but it was playing a janitor. Like I was typecast in a way, because I played a janitor in the movie, but then I was a janitor in a TV show called The Killing. And that role was kind of an eerie character. I was like, I was a janitor, pedophile janitor. It was creepy. And I had like
saw
a
that
small
show.
Role.
Ooh, now I'm going to rewatch it. Yeah. Just to watch you.
Yeah. It's episode 3, season 1, called El Diablo, if you guys are interested. But yeah, it was one of those roles that, that really took me to a very dark place in regards to preparation. And to this day, I still feel dirty and creepy about it. But the whole idea, where the casting director was getting me at, was to get into the most darkest and ugliest place. Like, no, I can't do this. I'll just pretend. And sure enough, I mean, I booked the role, but it was, the way I got it was kind of creepy. I didn't like it.
Yeah, I hear you.
But it was one of my favorite roles, don't get me wrong, but it was like, it was kind of creepy of how I got it. I didn't like that feeling. So I guess from there it was like, maybe I probably booked two, three more shows and whatever. And then my wife and I, at that point, we just got engaged, and the following year we were going to get married. And so it was a lot of preparation for that. And then that same year we got married, later on that year, 2017, my daughter was born. So we had a lot of things that, to me, I had to put on the back end for now and focus on the wedding and stuff. But at the same time, I still maintain a day job as well as theater sports.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard. And I totally feel you. We're in the same position of like, I want to be super creative and I want to do all these things. But like right now in the world, my mission right now is to take care of this kid. Like, that's what I'm doing. I've been doing theater for a long time. I feel the same way about, like, you know, once we prepared to get married, and then we, you know, my husband and I were married for 5 years before we had kids. Cause like I said, we were like, wait, what? Oh, we're having kids. but at the same time, like, once, now that he's here, like, it's, you know, I keep thinking about people like, oh, are you, you know, you're not around the theater as much. Is it like a problem? And I'm like, no, it's just, this is my life now. Like, I'm hanging out with him. He's a great dude. Like, I want to be with my boy for as long as I can. And he'll go to school soon, you know, eventually, a year or so. And then I can do whatever, you know, then I can be doing different things and figuring stuff out. Exactly. He's got an activity, I'll have an activity. But for right now.
Yeah. And you know, and that was a thing too. Like, and it was hard too, because we were living with my in-laws for a bit there too, while my little girl was born. So obviously doing like late hours with theater sports and having a day job, it took me away. And I felt like I couldn't do much and help. And so my in-laws would be there to help. But thankfully, they were there. But there was a lot of guilt on my side. Like, man, I got to be there more often. I got to be at home to help with the baby and whatnot. Because obviously, postmortem was a real thing. And I was so I felt so guilty that eventually, like, you know, during the shutdown or the lockdown of recently, it gave me a moment of pause. I'm like, oh, great. I get to hang out with my kid. My wife could still do some work, and I'm going to love every moment of this, because I felt like I lost a lot that, you know, this is going to be news to you, Amy. But yesterday I actually retired from theater sports and the improv community yesterday, because it was just too much for me to lose, and I wanted to be with my family more so. And so you caught me on the morning of my time doing improv, because I was there for 14 years and I have nothing but great memories and great people. You know, it was so much fun, but time was at an essence for me with my kid, and I was like, you know what, I want to be with my family now. And maybe this this pandemic probably was a benefit to me, because it gave me the opportunity to be with my family. So, So you got news.
I mean,
today,
you got
lady.
Right. This is one of those news podcasts. I'm revealing amazing news, and I mean, that's an important part of your journey for sure. You know, and I mean, I feel you. After I had the baby, I didn't do anything at the theater for 2 years. It was only 2 years after that I even kind of felt like I could come back. But
I mean,
the way that it works for you though, I mean, you say you retire, but like plausibly in 5 years, if you want to go do stuff, you can go back, right? Or is it like you had an earned spot in a group and now you're leaving that group, so like somebody else will fill in and you need to come back in a different way? I don't know how the institution of it works.
I'm turning,
you know?
46. Yeah, I'm turning 46 this year, and I mean, I feel like I do have a little bit left, but really, I've done a lot of shows for theater sports in the past, and they gave me so much opportunity learning the craft of improv. I mean, the highlights of my moment with theater sports is sharing the stage as a host for Colin Mochrie. Like this Canadian legend and Whose Line Is It Anyway star. And I did it twice in my lifetime. And also the best part with theater sports, I wasn't just a performer. I was also a tech improviser too. So I would do sound. I would do lighting for shows.
Oh,
so
nice.
I was the most versatile player in the company, because I could be either on stage. But if a technician was sick, I could hop up in the booth. And someone else would fill in my spot on stage for that night. So I was pretty versatile in that. And then also I was doing local shows as well too, for friends of mine who had their own little small groups called the Fictionals. And then another group would do shows called the Radicals. And so I would space myself out to the point where, you know, I think I was doing too much. I felt like I was doing too much to the point where I needed a couple. Well, yeah, I was doing too much, especially with a newborn, and you know, it was taking me. And I felt a lot of, there was so much guilt still that ultimately I was content. I was doing so much with like what I did, theater sports and the other improv companies I've had the pleasure of working with in the last few years or so. That we recently had an improv conference, it was international. Improv theater sports conference at our theater, and it was sort of like the Olympics or sort of like the UN coming to our theater, and you could see all these performers doing their take on what improv is like, and Dan O'Connor from LA doing his genre piece, and it was like so amazing work, such amazing work that I happened to tech one of Dan O'Connor, improviser in LA. He came up and he directed like local improvisers from our company and other people like Patty Styles and whatnot. And at the end of it, Amy, I had never seen it ever in my life, but they got a standing ovation. I was so happy to be witnessing that, and the fact that I teched that, it gave me such a high. I was like, I went up to my colleagues who I do shows with after, is like, guys, I bow to you guys because you guys got that. And I support that because that was amazing. And then went to Dan and I was like, man, it was such a great feeling seeing another variation of what improv could be. And it was challenging times up in Vancouver, trying to learn new things or try to bring new things, because here, it's always about comedy. It's always about, you know, theater sports, and it's all about the fast paced, quick wit stuff. And what Dan brought to introduce me was slow pace improv doing dramatic style, complete one act play. No laughs. Yeah, you'll get the laughs, but being honest and true and whatnot. And it left a huge impression on me that, to me, I eventually started bringing that to myself on stage, bring the realism, bringing, you know, the idea of what true emotions could be. I think I did a scene one time where it was supposed to be like, you know, robbing a bank, and I stood there being held up, and I actually started crying on stage, like as if I was the person being held up. And one of my improvisers colleagues came up to me afterwards, like, are you okay? I'm like, yeah, why? It's like, I didn't know how to react to that, because you actually started crying on stage. Like, oh no, that's my character. I was just like, I didn't want to be shot. That was what I was thinking in my head. I didn't want to get shot because I have a family to worry about. And then all of a sudden it was like all this realism in my head started popping in. I'm like, okay, this is too real to me. Not that I ever got held up ever in my life, but the fact, the idea that sort of came in my true emotions, I was like, and that came from Dan O'Connor. Like, it was just like eerily, it was awesome. It was such a great feeling. And so that whole conference itself was such a great exposure to what improv could be and what it should be. And that's just community and love for each other. It was great. I loved it a lot.
Dude, you got to go to Europe and Asia now. Okay, I know that you just said that you weren't going to do improv anymore, but so they won't do that improv. Europe and Asia is all about the dramatic stuff. They think
the genre.
Think the comedy stuff is gauche. Like, I've talked to people and they're like, oh yeah, we know you guys do the comedy stuff, sure.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, is it not cool? We're not cool? And I always accept that as an American, I'm not cool. And I'm fine with that, you know? But so many people, you'd love it. Oh my God.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I've met a couple of people from Austin who came up here for our improv tournament, Roy and I think Casey Beeler.
Yeah.
You know, they're a company that does genre piece type improv. And that's something that was introduced to me late last year. I was like, oh, I never knew anything about that. And then we had a company come out from Hawaii, and Garrick and whatnot. They introduced us to what they do quite often was a lot of genre pieces. And one of them was Kabuki improv.
Oh.
And it was like a Harold style, but Kabuki, honest Kabuki characters, not mocking it or whatever. It was like true to form. And then I went on their website, and they're all about the genre. genre pieces of improv, like doing a Harry Potter version, but with doing with true, honest Harry Potter. They actually, I think they got like dialect coaches to help them with their British accent, so they're not besmirching it. It was like, wow, you guys went all out on that. Like, that's crazy. And then the bonus is that because they're tapping into something like Harry Potter or whatever, they get hired to do roving characters for fan act, like cosplay shows, right? So that's a, like, side job. That's a side job from what they already do already. So that was like, that's a bonus. So
if you're into cosplay and you want to like figure out a way to make money with it, go to a genre-based improv school and learn. You're right. That's exactly how you do that. You want to be the, you know, you've always wanted to be, you know, Cinderella at Disney World, but they said no to you last time. Take one class. You'll go back. They'll be like, oh my God, it's like she's in front of me. Like it's, they really just get it. You know what I mean? And I can't believe they get into those genres so quickly. Like, don't get me wrong, I know there's a lot of work on a lot of shows. I've watched them come out of rehearsal and it's like, whoa, they look tired. But at the same time, well, like, wow.
Yeah. And that's what was so fascinating with like this improv group from Hawaii. And then also Casey, people from watching those guys do it. And I was like, that's something that we in Vancouver don't do a lot of. Like, obviously, it's theater sports based, so, you know, like, Whose Line Is Anyway type style, but not really that style, but the handles of that. Mm-hmm. And it was like, yeah, you know, you could do those, you could do scene through ways so many times. It'll still be fun if you make it fun. But finding new ways of doing improv and watching improv and whatnot, it's hard to really cultivate that here in Vancouver because our audience is so used to watching the Whose Line Is It Anyway with the Colin Mockeries and whatnot. So introducing them to a long form, for example, like a 20-minute long form to a 25-minute long form, they'll get it, but not this. I don't want to say that our audience are dumb, but we have to downplay it so they understand what's going on in the sense of like doing a Harold.
It's hard to get the audience into improv when you're doing a montage or something like that. And it's like a bunch of disconnected scenes. Like, what are they involved in at all? Right.
So they have a hard
time connecting. Whenever I teach level one improv, and it's mostly just montage improv that I'm teaching at that point, it's like when you do your improv, when you do your recital at the end of this level one class, like the people who are having the fun are you. Not that we're not enjoying and deeply supportive of you, but you're the one who's having fun. You can't possibly learn how to do it and make people like it in one level. Like, sorry, you have to know how to do it first. And then you can work on making people like it, you know? You have to get real good at it before you can get the audience in on it. And then they're like, I see what's happening. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's funny. Like, I mean, during this whole time, you know, you talked about you were watching something on Tiger King. You were talking about Tiger King. And and then prior to that, like, I mean, prior to lockdown, I heard nothing about this show called Middleditch and Schwartz.
Oh, yeah.
Middleditch and Schwartz. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, okay, I don't know much about these guys. I'll watch it. And then I started reading a little bit more information. Oh, they're an improv duo. Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's see how they could pull this off. Because Whose Line? I'm surprised they somehow really pull it off doing improv as a TV platform. It's, you know, without looking like it's fabricated and whatnot. So for them to do it, for these two to do it, I was like, wow, you guys are killing it. Like, I was just so amazed what Middleditch and Schwartz did. I was like, that's so inspiring. And they only have 3 episodes, but if you guys have a chance to watch it, my gosh, they're such a fun duo. Like,
I loved that they did 3 episodes. You know what I mean? I thought they were just going to do one, you know, like a stand-up set. But instead they were like, no, here's 3 different shows. And I knew that they were doing it because they actually toured the country and came to Austin a couple of times. So like they worked on doing this live show for a long time. And I think they were doing the live show just to do the live show at first in major improv cities around around the country. But then they were like, hey, let's maybe Netflix or somebody came to them and was like, hey, let's film this. I believe, if I understand correctly, because I listened to interviews with them on other podcasts like this, they were like, really? You want to film it? It's not great filmed. And they were like, no, no, we want to make a comedy special. And they're like, again, you know, we're doing improv, right? Like, this is different.
Yeah. And I think, you know, there's a lot of, and there's a lot of things you could take away from there as, you know, as a performer or even a student, not what they, what, how their character or transitions, whatever. It's actually one thing I find very fascinating that not a lot of improvisers could do properly is interview an audience and get suggestions from their life and just walk them through it, not besmirching them, whatever. And having, it was like, oh, so, okay, you're from this place? Oh, interesting. Okay, can you tell us a little bit of that? Not a lot of improvisers have a proper skill in doing that, I find. It's such a, I find it's like a unique thing. It's like hosting a show. It's its own beast. It's its own entity compared to actually performing in a show. And so watching both of them just talk to an audience member about how, what they want for as an inspiration for their scenes, I find that very fascinating how they actually interview an audience member, because it was with such care, with such honesty of how they really feel about the suggestions or what they're getting. And, you know, when they hear something like, oh, this person was the best man. I didn't know I was the best man. Like, whoa, okay, hold up. Let's back up a little bit. And they took their time with it. There was no rush to it. Maybe for TV reasons that they didn't have to rush it. I think they were just killing airtime. But it was just really fascinating watching how they just really set up their show. Like, just so, and it was also making sure that the entire audience knew what was going to happen, because they were setting up the audience, like what we do as improvisers, setting up your partner to be successful. They made that, they made their audience look so successful and loved by that crowd. It was quite fascinating. Like, I mean, and then overall the show itself was just fantastic to watch, but I thought that was the one thing that really gravitated to, is like, no one, even including myself, I have a tough time talking to an audience member about a day in their life, because it's you don't want to get too personal, but you also, you don't want to be too cheeky about it, but you also want to be, you want to honor what they're giving you and not look down at them if it's like something you didn't like. It was kind of fascinating.
Man, that's so great. I love that, you know, there's more improv and sketch comedy available for us to be watching just at home while we're on quarantine. And with the breadth of, you know, using Zoom across the world, you can be involved in, you know, like improv jams or watching shows all across the country. Not even the country, the world. You can watch improv all across the world. And I think it's a great thing that you're so smart to mention. It's not, don't just watch this show to be like, oh, aren't they cute, aren't they fun, they're ha ha ha. It's like, what could you learn from them? And I love that you pulled that detail out of it. And that's why I'm gonna say that, despite the fact that you've used the phrase retirement, I don't believe, VJ, that this is the last show that you're ever gonna do. You have been a self-starter from the beginning, creating shows, helping other people create shows, putting things out there, trying to find ways to get yourself and other people on stage. You are meant to do that kind of thing. And you know what? Now you have time. You're not involved with the theater sports as much anymore. So now you and your friends, you're going to go to the Philippines. I can feel it. You're going to make it happen. It's going to be great. And you're going to do really serious, dramatic improv. And it's going to be so awesome. You're just like the energy of what you have put out, and not only just telling me the story, but like the energy of helping the other people and doing and working on, you know, different communities and helping them embrace the, you know, theater that they love and get to play with improv. That's part of who you are. And you're just going to keep doing more stuff like that. Right now, you and me, we got to hang out with some toddlers for a little bit, but pretty soon we're back out making shows, making everybody laugh or cry, whatever we want to do. It's going to be great.
Well, to me, like, and you know, I always looked at it like, for me, and this is just my own personal belief, like whenever I'm doing a show, not to sound mean or whatever to my colleagues, I've done shows before, but I know I rarely perform for my colleagues or entertain them, as much as that's the added bonus, it's always the crowd. And if the crowd's loving everything you're doing and you're giving them an opinion about you, that's what it's worth. And I am an actor. Yes, I'm an actor. I love the limelight, but it's always been about the crowd. And as great as it is to learn from my fellow colleagues, which I do always, I always still love, I think it's because my upbringing of theater from my drama teacher is to respect the stage. And I think that's what I try to do, is respect that stage and respect the audience for watching me on that stage.
Totally. So great. Thank you so much for being on the podcast. Thank you so much for sharing your stories. It has been an absolute pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you very much, Amy. And thank you for the opportunity to tell you that I'm retiring. Or am I?
Thanks for listening to Yes But Why Podcast. Check out all our episodes on yesbutwhypodcast.com or check out all the content on our network, HC Universal, at hcuniversalnetwork.com.